Welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. This is a part 6 of A Plantation Life Before Emancipation, and we will start with Chapter 17, What Was Done for the Negro by Other Men and Women, Ministers, Churches and Communities. One can but be amused with the simplicity with which George Mueller avows that his great orphanage, with its 2,000 inmates, was conducted entirely upon the principle of making its wants known exclusively to God. The condensed history of the straits to which it was from time to time reduced, and wonderfully relieved in answer to prayer, with the story of the governing principle and the wants of the orphans annually published and paraded throughout the United Kingdom, was the strongest and most effective appeal for human help. His practice was more scriptural than his theory. There was no such incompatibility between the theory and the practice of our philanthropist missionary. He combined work with prayer and gave due credit to each. Referring to his early commercial life, I remember to have heard him say that there was room even in a merchant's avocation for the largest exercise of intellect. Had he been permitted to serve God and his generation in that calling, he would have been among the foremost not only in success but intelligence. He would have familiarized himself with the history of ancient and modern commerce, with countries and their productions, with the highways of the seas and lands, and modes of transportation and the laws of finance. Now all this thoroughness of information, breadth of view, firmness of grasp, clearness of vision, and painstaking industry he carried into his life work. He informed himself concerning the history of African slavery and the numbers and condition, physical and spiritual, of the Negro race in America. And bearing upon his great heart the immortal interests, not only of the 4,000 slaves, constituting, we may say, his immediate pastoral charge, but of the 2,000,000 of them scattered throughout the South. He, while diligently cultivating his own particular field, took within his sympathetic vision the entire area of slavery, and laboured as earnestly to have accomplished by other hands the same work that he, with his co-labourers, was doing in his native county. It is this last peculiarity which makes the work I have undertaken in this letter easy. Only 4 out of the 13 reports rendered to the Association for the Religious Instruction of the Negro are confined to county work. The balance give each in turn a more or less complete review of the work being done by other hands throughout the Southern Church. To relate all that was accomplished by Southern Christians and philanthropists for the salvation and elevation of the Negro slave would necessitate a protracted and difficult investigation, in which the labour involved would probably outweigh the result. With the aid of Dr. Jones' reports, we hope to be able to give such specimens as will inspire us with an exalted opinion of the Southern slaveholder. We begin with the following candid and fearless presentation of the lamentable condition of the Negro when the great movement began throughout the South, in which Dr. Jones was not the only, but certainly the most potent factor. It is from his pen and bears the date of 1834. The Negroes have no regular and efficient ministry. As a matter of course, no churches. Neither is there sufficient room in white churches for their accommodation. We know of but 5 churches in the slaveholding states built expressly for their use. The galleries or back seats on the lower floor of white churches are generally appropriated to the Negroes when it can be done with convenience to the whites. Where it cannot be done conveniently, the Negroes who attend must catch the gospel as it escapes by the doors and windows. From an extensive observation, we venture to say that not a 20th part of the Negroes throughout the southern states attend divine worship on the Sabbath. They have no Bibles to read at their firesides, they have no family altars, and when in affliction, sickness or death, they have no ministers to address to them the consolations of the gospel, nor to bury them with solemn and appropriate services. For the most part, they depend upon those of their own colour, who perform them as well as they know how, if they happen to be at hand. It must not be inferred from these statements that the neglect was by any means universal. Even the sombreness of this picture is relieved by such sunny touches as these. Sometimes a kind master will perform these offices. Here and there, a master feels interested for the salvation of his servants and is attempting something towards it in assembling them at evening for scripture reading and prayer, in admitting and inviting qualified persons to preach to them, or in establishing a daily or weekly school for the children, and in conducting the labour and discipline of the plantation upon gospel principles. We rejoice that there are such, and that the number is increasing. There were no doubt a faithful 7,000, if not more, in his as in Elijah's day. The reports show a steady improvement in all particulars. We read of churches being built for them in Liberty County and elsewhere by slave owners, of men and women stirred up to personal work for the salvation of their people, and of ecclesiastical bodies taking up the matter in good earnest and resolving and going to work in the neglected field with the most gratifying results all over the South. We wish it were in our power to publish the statements in extensio proving this, but we can only give specimens culled here and there from the broad and inviting field of these interesting annual reports. Under the head of individual efforts, take these illustrations. Details of a Plan for the Moral Improvement of Negroes on Plantations by Thomas S. Clay of Bryan County, Georgia. Mr. Clay was a large rice planter on the Ogeechee River, a bosom friend of Dr. Jones and living in the adjoining county. In the matter of control upon gospel principles and religious instruction, his large plantation was a model, and his tractate was simply a publication to the Christian world of his mode of thus managing it. This is said as far back as 1833 of a Virginia planter of Albemarle County, the owner of 250 slaves. He made special efforts to have the gospel preached to them. The consequence was that their whole condition and appearance were improved surprisingly. About 30 became professing Christians, and upwards of 90 joined the Temperance Society. This gentleman made liberal offers to any minister who would undertake the instruction of his people. This is just one of many examples of planters mentioned as thus faithful and liberal in offering to pay sufficient salaries to any who would preach to their servants. A gentleman in New Orleans, to whom a report of the association and also the report of the Synod of South Carolina and Georgia had been forwarded, writes as follows. As the black population of this state are immersed in religious ignorance, the circulation of these reports among the owners of slaves here might, I would hope, awaken them to a sense of their duty. Ordering 150 copies of each, he continues, "The system of instruction recommended in the reports had been pursued by me for a long series of years with signal success to my own private interests, the individual interests and happiness of my servants, and with the result of an entire change in their moral and religious character, and their habits of industry and submission to superiors." In the report for the year 1843, a lady writes to him, "I have from childhood felt a deep interest and have been much engaged in the religious instruction of the coloured people. I have used Brown's Catechism always. Your book meets fully my views and wishes." His extensive correspondence all over the South brings to light many a faithful minister with a kindred zeal, giving half or all his time to the religious instruction of the Negro. In the second annual report, he quotes as follows from letters. A clergyman in Natchez writes, "I have committed to me the instruction of the Negroes on 5 plantations, in all about 300, the owners of whom are professors of religion. I usually preach 3 times on the Sabbath, and after each sermon I spend a short time catechizing. I have occasionally meetings for inquiry." From Oakland College, Mississippi, one writes, "I have 3 or 4 meetings on the Sabbath. I preach once in a fortnight in the church, where about 300 blacks assemble. 5 of the plantations which I attend are within 2 miles of the church, 4 others between 4 and 6 miles. I endeavour to visit all the plantations once in 2 weeks. I go among the people, talk with them face to face, visit the sick, and pray with them. From the Savannah River, I visit 18 plantations every 2 weeks, catechise the children and pray with the sick in the week, preach 2 or 3 on the Sabbath. The owners have built 3 good churches at their own expense, all framed, 290 members have been added, and about 400 children are instructed each week. We go outside of our record to add an additional illustrative item, for which we are indebted to the Southwestern Presbyterium. Speaking of Reverend James Smiley, Reverend Henry MacDonald writes in its columns, "In his old age, Mr. Smiley devoted his time exclusively to the religion of the Negroes. He had a large congregation of them. In addition to preaching the gospel to them and reading to them the scriptures, he taught them the catechism. He used not only the primary catechism, but the shorter catechism of the Westminster Assembly. Large classes of them could recite the whole of that catechism. He prepared a catechism for the coloured people, which was adopted and recommended by the Synod of Mississippi. This was before Dr. Jones published his catechism for them." I cannot take up the space necessary to give specimens of the reports, resolutions, and narratives passed or adopted by ecclesiastical bodies as they are given at length in these reports. The information which they incidentally communicated shows that there was a most wonderful awakening upon this subject throughout the Southern Zion. Equal space is impartially given in these reports, which you will search in vain to ascertain the missionaries' denominational predilections, to the proceedings of conferences, associations, councils, and synods, and it is indeed hard to ascertain to which denomination of the one holy Catholic Church, Methodist, Baptist, Episcopal, or Presbyterian, belongs the honour of marching in the van of this host of Southern slave-holding Christians, intent upon conquering by truth and love Africa in America for Christ. The full particulars of this evangelistic work among the Negroes by Southern Christians may never be written upon earth, but they are certainly inscribed by the recording angel in the Book of Record of the Chronicles of Heaven, and to their everlasting honour they will be read out by the King himself, in the presence of an assembled universe, what day the books shall be opened, and God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or evil. Chapter 18, The Seaboard of South Carolina. Lands intersected by a narrow frith abhor each other, mountains interposed make enemies of nations who had else, like kindred drops, been mingled into one. And that's by Cowper. While not foes, only the beautiful and narrow savannah divides the Georgia seaboard from the South Carolina coast. The same features mark the landscape, the fringe of long, narrow, low islands crowned with live oak, cedar, palmetto, and myrtle, and beating back the thundering surf, the wide waving salt marshes, broken here and there by deep, broad estuaries, and everywhere intersected by winding streams as the tide rises or falls, now filling, now receding from the mud banks, and periodically overflowing in wide inundation the meadows, and gleaming like ribbons of silver upon a robe of green and stocked with fish, high yellow, sandy, pine-covered bluffs, ornamented with planters' summer residences, broad stretches of rich alluvial lands, waving with golden rice or snowy with Sea Island cotton, boundless forests of longleaf pine, intersected by swamps, woods fragrant with magnolia and yellow jessamine, and fields and forests abounding with small and large game. Was it a wonder that one of the old navigators, Sir Walter Raleigh, I believe, thus wrote of it, "The great spreading oaks, the infinite store of cedars, the palms and bay trees of so sovereign odour that balm smelleth nothing in comparison, the meadows divided asunder into isles and islets, interlacing one another, these made the place so pleasant that those who are melancholic would be forced to change their humour." Whether it was due to the sameness of origin or shaping influence of similar environment, the inhabitants of these two sections of the South, in one of which the writer had his experience of slavery as before described, were in many respects strikingly alike. There was the same refinement and open-handed hospitality, the same fondness in the men for outdoor sports and skilful use of gun and rod, and splendid horsemanship. Their speech, too, was alike. Competent critics have affirmed that nowhere in the world was the English language spoken in greater purity than among the low country people of these two sister states. The relations between slave and master were such as have already been described as prevailing on the Georgia seacoast. The Negro population was vastly in excess of the white, but perfectly orderly. To a friend, a minister of the same church with myself, who consecrated to the work from student days to the war, laboured in this earthly paradise, I am indebted for the following information concerning the efforts of the church to give the gospel to the Negro in their region. I give it in his language. Let me jot down some statements which may be of use to you. Number 1. Previously to the war, the coast of South Carolina was covered by a network of missions among the slaves, conducted by the Methodist Episcopal Church South. These missions were not the same as the circuits, nor were they embraced in them, but were served by separate ministers devoted to them. They were mainly supported by the planters. Besides preaching, the functions of the missionaries included catechizing of the children and visiting the sick on the plantations. It was a great work. Number 2. The pastors of the Presbyterian Church regularly preached to the colored people, large numbers of whom were members of their churches. In addition to this, some of them preached regularly on plantations, catechizing the Negro children and youth and visiting the sick. This was also a great work. Number 3. The ministers of other evangelical denominations partook in similar labours. In the country along the Santee River, Reverend Alexander Glennie, an Episcopal clergyman, devoted special attention to the religious instruction of the Negroes. Bishop Gadsden of South Carolina has this to say of Reverend Stephen Elliott. For so many years, the eloquent preacher and revered bishop of the Episcopal Church in Georgia, he built a chapel at his own expense for the colored people in Prince William's Parish, and resigned his white charge that he might devote his entire care to the population of that parish, doing it zealously, faithfully, and gratuitously. Number 4. In cases in which families or members of families were pious, great attention was bestowed upon the instruction of the slaves, especially the children, and Sabbath schools on plantations were maintained. Number 5. A special enterprise in 1848 was begun for the more thoroughgoing evangelization of the colored people in Charleston, under the auspices of the Reverend John B. Adger and the session of the Second Presbyterian Church. A brick house was built at a cost of $7,500. In 1859, in consequence of the enormous growth of the congregation, another church building, which cost $25,000, contributed by the citizens of Charleston, was dedicated. This house was 100 foot long by 80 broad, and was on a basement, divided into two rooms, which afforded ample convenience for prayer meetings, catechizing of classes, and personal instruction of candidates for membership. From the first, the great building was filled, the blacks occupying the main floor and the whites the galleries, when seated 250 persons. The enterprise began as a branch congregation of the Second Presbyterian Church, then became a missionary church under Reverend J. L. Girardeau, evangelist of Charleston Presbytery, and finally, in consequence of the admission of white members, a white church with a white session. The close of the war found it with exactly 500 colored members and nearly 100 white. Such was its growth from organization as a mission church in 1857 with only 48 members. Presbyterian readers need not be informed that the faithful minister thus mentioned as connected with this remarkable enterprise is none other than the learned and able professor of theology in our beloved School of the Prophets in Columbia, Reverend John L. Girardeau. We doubt if the honoured position to which he had been called by the unanimous voice of his church, and for so long a time, has ably filled, gives a satisfaction greater than that which fills his soul when he recalls the work done for his master among the lowly, gathered within the sacred walls of Zion Church, erected by Southern slaveholders for the slave. We take the liberty of supplementing the brief account already quoted of this remarkable work by the following fuller statement, which we find in the Southern Presbyterian Review of July 1854. It is no violence of confidence to say that the article, although anonymous, is from the pen of the honoured missionary himself. It is headed Report of a Conference by Presbytery on the Subject of the Organisation, Instruction and Discipline of the Coloured People. the debate covering all the ground as it did, and participated in by men having a practical acquaintance with the subject, must have been deeply interesting, as the report shows it was thorough and able. We extract the paragraph containing evident reference to Zion Church in Charleston. The question of the segregation of the blacks from the whites in public worship was not at that time considered, simply because the policy of Presbytery in that matter had already been settled and openly adopted. It has been the almost universal practice of our ministers for many years to convene the people into separate congregations and dispense to them instructions suited to their exigencies, and at the meeting of this presbytery at Barnwell in April 1847, a formal sanction was afforded to this practice, by the extension of its approval and patronage, to a scheme contemplating the establishment of a separate congregation of blacks of the Second Presbyterian Church in Charleston. The reasons for the collection of the coloured people into distinct congregations have been ably stated by Reverend J. B. Adger in a sermon preached in Charleston, May 9, 1847, and by Reverend Dr. Thornwell in a critical notice of this discourse published shortly after its delivery in the Southern Presbyterian Review. The want of room in all our church edifices, the necessity of a style of instruction adapted to the capacities and attainments of the coloured population, and their destitute and neglected condition under the pressure of powerful temptations, constitute cogent arguments in favour of the erection of separate congregations for their benefit. It cannot be denied that there are great advantages resulting from the union of masters and servants in the solemn offices of religion, advantages secured by the conviction produced by this association of a common origin, a common relation to God, and a common interest in the great scheme of redemption through the blood of Christ. But the question, as has been observed, was soon found to be partial separation or a partial diffusion of the gospel among the slaves, and an enlarged philanthropy prevailed over sentiment. It ought to be kept in mind that this separation into distinct congregations does not amount to a compulsory or total exclusion of the servants from access to the churches in which their masters worship. They are at liberty to associate with them in worship whenever they will, while these edifices and religious services, intended especially for their benefit, are standing invitations to those among them for whose welfare no man cares to participate in the blessings provided by the gospel. It is also to be remembered that a complete separation cannot, and in fact does not, take place under this plan, inasmuch as it contemplates the presence of some white persons, a measure indeed made necessary by civil statutes. As therefore servants are not debarred from worshipping at pleasure with their masters, as it is expected that in all their assemblages white persons should be present, and as these congregations are served by white ministers, themselves responsible to ecclesiastical courts representing large sections of the community, it is next to impossible that a class worship, as it is frequently objected, should be the result of the enforcement of this scheme, or that it should tend to foster feelings of insubordination and aggravate the prejudices of caste by connecting them with the institutions of religion. How far this remarkable and successful experiment of a separate organisation in part of coloured people, officered entirely by white persons, would, had our civil war not intervened, have won its way into the dense mass of the slave population, and to what extent it would have shaped southern evangelisation of the Negro, it were idle now to speculate. Besides its great success in winning from among them scores of precious souls for Christ, the history is important and valuable as furnishing another striking proof of the Southern slaveholders' fidelity to the highest interests of the slave. Chapter 19. Personal Recollections of Another Missionary to the Blacks. Reverend Dr. Mallard. My dear brother, I hardly know how to communicate personal reminiscences. They would be numerous and detailed. Perhaps I had better not enter the edge of the forest, but I adventure a few which may be of some use to you. If not, throw them out. Of course, you do not expect to mention my name. I remember that before I became a preacher, I used to hold meetings on my father's plantation, the cotton house affording a convenient place of assemblage. Previously, the plantation resounded with the sounds of jollity, the merry strains of the fiddle, the measured beat of the quar sticks, and the rhythmical shuffling and patting of the feet in the Ethiopian jig. Now the fiddle and the quar sticks were abandoned, and the light carnal song gave way to psalms and hymns. The congregations were numerous and attentive, and a genuine revival of religion seemed to obtain. I can never forget with what enthusiasm they used to sing their own improvised spiritual. My brother, you promised Jesus, my brother, you promised Jesus, my brother, you promised Jesus to either fight or die. Oh, I wish I was there to hear my Jesus orders. Oh, I wish I was there, Lord, to wear my starry crown. On another plantation, which I was in the habit of visiting, a prayer meeting was commenced by one or two young men, which became more and more solemn until the religious interest grew intense and a powerful revival took place, which involved the White family and their neighbours. The results of that meeting were marked, and some of its fruits remain to this day. If ever I witnessed an outpouring of the Spirit, I did then. While teaching school in another place, it was my custom to visit plantations in rotation on certain afternoons of the week, and catechise and exhort the slaves. I knew of but one planter in that community who objected to this practice, and he was an irreligious man. On Sabbath, after the regular services of the sanctuary had been held and the white congregation had dispersed, the negroes would crowd the church building, and standing on the pulpit steps, I would address them. Their feelings sometimes were irrepressible. This was with the sanction of the minister and the elders. While at the theological seminary, I only refrained from going on a foreign mission because I felt it to be my duty to preach to the mass of slaves on the seaboard of South Carolina. Having rejected, after licensure, a call to a large and important church, which had very few negroes connected with it, I accepted an invitation to preach temporarily to a small church which was surrounded by a dense body of slaves. The scenes on Sabbath were affecting. The negroes came in crowds from two parishes. Often have I seen, a scene I reckon not often witnessed, groups of them double-quicking in the roads in order to reach the church on time, trotting to church. The white service, as many negroes as could be attending, being over, the slaves would pour in and throng the seats vacated by their masters, yes, crowd the building up to the pulpit. I have seen them rock to and fro under the influence of their feelings like a wood in a storm. What singing, what hearty handshakings after the service! I've had my finger joints stripped of the scarf skin in consequence of them. Upon leaving the church after the last mournful service with them, and going to my vehicle, which was some 100 yards distant, a poor little native African woman followed me, weeping and crying out, "Oh, Massa, you're going to leave us? Oh, Massa, for Jesus' sake, don't leave us." I had made an engagement with another church, or the poor little African's plea might have prevailed. When next I visited that people, I asked after my little African friend. "She crossed over, sir," was the answer. "May we meet when parting will be no more. The song to Jesus never ceases." The church to which I next went was in a different part of the seaboard of South Carolina. In connection with it, I was ordained, and here my work began in earnest. The congregation included some of the most cultivated gentlemen of the state. They were cordially in favour of the religious instruction of the slaves. The work among them consisted of preaching to them on Sabbath noons in the church building in which their masters had just worshipped, preaching to them again in the afternoons on the plantations, and preaching at night to mixed congregations of whites and blacks. This in summer. In winter, I preached at night on the plantations, often reaching home after midnight. Many a time I have seen the slaves gathered at their masters' piazzas for worship, and when it was very cold, in their dining rooms and their sitting rooms. The family and the servants would worship together. This was common, and the fact deserves to be signalized. In order better to compass the work, I selected 4 points in the congregational territory, the diameter of which was about 20 miles in one direction, and proposed to secure the erection of meeting houses which would each be central to several plantations, in order to economize labor and bring the gospel more frequently in contact with the people, by preaching once a month on Sabbaths at those points. This plan was prevented accomplishment by my removal to the missionary work in Charleston. It is curious that after the war, the coloured people erected houses of worship at those very points. My last service with the Negroes at this church I will never forget. The final words had been spoken to the white congregation, and they had retired, when a tempest of emotion was shaking me behind the desk. The tramp of a great multitude was heard as the Negroes poured into the building and occupied all available space up to the old wineglass-shaped pulpit. When approaching the conclusion of the sermon, I turned to the unconverted, asked what I should say to them, and called on them to come to Jesus. At this moment, the great mass of the congregation simultaneously broke down, dropped their heads to their knees, and uttered a wail which seemed to prelude the judgment. Poor people, they had deeply appreciated the preaching of the gospel to them. Into the details of the work in Charleston I cannot enter. They would occupy too much space. It lasted with me from 1854 to 1862. I have sometimes thought I devoted too much time to it. I was absorbed in it. But the labour was not in vain, I trust. Besides Sabbath preaching, most of the nights of the week were spent at the church in the discharge of various duties, holding prayer meetings, catechising classes, administering discipline, settling difficulties, and performing marriage ceremonies. Often have I sat for over an hour in a cold room, instructing individual inquirers and candidates for membership. Often have I arisen in the night to visit the sick and dying and administer baptism to ill children. I made it a duty to attend all their funerals and conduct them. Just two extreme instances of dying experience I will give you. One was that of a servant of a distinguished judge. He was dying. As I entered his room, he rubbed his hands together and chuckled with a hilarious delight, like that of a boy going home on Christmas Eve, and exclaimed, "I'm going home! Oh, how glad I am!" So he passed away. Another was that of my own servant. He was reared by me, was a bad boy when he grew up, attended my church, professed conversion, and was seized not very long after with galloping consumption. He was in terror. His sins filled him with dismay. I laboured with him, but he refused to be comforted. At last, not long before his departure, the light of God's reconciled countenance broke upon the midnight of his soul. From that time he had perfect peace and breathed his last. I firmly believe on the bosom of his Saviour. Freely did my tears flow while I was uttering the last words of prayer and exhortation over his encoffined body. His mother, also my servant, died after him during the war while I was absent in Virginia. She kept calling for me till she expired. Tell me that there was no true deep affection of masters to slaves and slaves to masters. It was often like that between near relatives. The most glorious work of grace I ever felt or witnessed was one which occurred in 1858 in connection with this missionary work in Charleston. It began with a remarkable exhibition of the Spirit's supernatural power. For 8 weeks, night after night, save Saturday nights, I preached to dense and deeply moved congregations. The result I have given in the general statement prefixed. The work steadily and rapidly grew until it was arrested by the war. I could give you some incidents that would be interesting, but time will not permit. One I mention in which the ludicrous and pathetic were blended, and the saying was fulfilled that the fountains of laughter and tears are near to each other. After a session had been formed, there came before it for admission into the church a small native African whose name was Cujo. The following colloquy occurred between the minister and the candidate. "Cujo, you want to join the church?" "Yesi, massa." "Cujo, you love Jesus?" "Yesi, massa, me love Jesus." "Cujo, you expect to see Jesus?" "Oh, yesi, massa, me spec I see Jesus." "When he sees you coming, what do you think Jesus will say?" "He say, 'Cujo, you come.'" I say, "Yesi, ma'am, I come." Here he struck his hands together, and the session laughed and cried at the same time. The conduct of this church after the war justified the wisdom of those who projected it. They clung to the white people. One of the first invitations in writing which I received upon my return from imprisonment at Johnson's Island, and while yet in the interior of the state, where my family were refugees in July 1865 to resume labour, was from this coloured membership, entreating me to come back and preach to them as of old. For years they declined to separate themselves from the Southern Presbyterian Church, and even after its assembly had, in 1874, recommended an organic separation of the whites and blacks, they continued to maintain an independent position. Only at a later date did they resolve to connect themselves with the Northern Presbyterian Church. But I must close, lest I tire you. I am, dear brother, yours in the Lord. I make no apology for giving the above letter just as it was written in response to my request for personal reminiscences of work among the blacks. It was not in my heart to alter a word or suppress a line of that which I have not been able to read a single time without tears. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for part 7 of Plantation Life Before Emancipation.